Call the House Transportation Committee to order. It is about 7 minutes after 1 on March 24th, 2011. And let the record show that the House members that were present were Representative Pruitt, Representative Peterson, and myself, Representative Wilson. And I'd like to recognize our staff, Nancy Hemingway, our House Recording Secretary, Karen Stewart, the LIO Monitor, and my committee aide is Becky Rooney. And before we start, please turn off your cell phones. And today we'll bring up House Bill 158 again, and it will amend the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority enabling statutes. And we had some public testimony when we last heard this bill, and there were some issues raised that I believe need addressing. So I'll first ask the sponsor if he'd like to say a few words, and then I'll invite Kavada people to testify, followed by DOT and then the Department of Revenue. So but Representative Newman, would you like to say a few words?
Thank you, Chair Wilson, and committee members, Representative Mark Newman, District 15 of beautiful Susitna River Valley, which is on the north end of the Kinnick Arm Bridge. You know, we've recently seen some population numbers there for the forecast and how fast we've grown out in our district, and it's exactly what we expected. You know, I could say I think I've worked harder than all other legislators because I have more constituents, but that's too easy. No, we are one of the fastest area growing areas of the state, and there's several issues to look at here. And obviously, this is a huge transportation project that we're looking at here, developing new areas of the state. We haven't had one of those in a long time. And we're looking at a public-private partnership that will be created. A fund out of this will help move this forward. But this is just another step in a long process. That is a public process, a very transparent process that Kubota has gone through. And I've been a member of the board, a non-voting member of the board, for 4 years now, and been very involved in the process along the way. And after receiving their record of decision again this last November, which allows to continue this to move forward, the federal permitting process into the side of the deal, and a lot of different organizations have looked at this, from the federal government to Kubota's to their private partners that they've looked at. And again, this is just another step in that bridge that we need to cross to continue to move these projects along. Now, with assuming 158 would move along, we would create a mechanism to create a fund to help cover the costs while tolls increase across the bridge. That fund will be repaid back, and then excess funds will be going back in towards transportation projects into the state. Now, before this project can happen after 158, and I've got the experts here to try and they'll walk through that mechanism more clearly than I can because they deal with it on a day-to-day basis. But in essence, allowing the private partners, the state, to come back and look at this again and see what the deal is. You know, here's the total cost, here's construction timelines. Then the state will decide whether they want to enter into these agreements with public or private partnerships on that to continue these projects to move forward. But I also want to touch on the safety aspects, and that's a big, big part of what we're doing here, I think, too. Again, there is not the room to expand on the Glen Highway, basically replacing all the bridges along through there. And any one of those bridges go out, we have the traffic routes that flow north out of there, the Prudhoe Bay, the oil fields out of the largest hub in a state out of Anchorage, Port of Anchorage, disconnected from the rest of the state. I mean, there's real safety issues that go on there for the safety, well-being, even the running operations of the state, and how that affects the state of Alaska and the potential. And then the road projects to expand Alaska, as we were directed to do that. But, Madam Chair, I could probably ramble on for quite a while on what I think the benefits are on this, but we've got the experts here to answer the questions that were brought up in the past. One thing that I will want to point out is the ICER report on the population studies, which will obviously affect the number of people that cross the bridge. They were 11% higher than even the ICER report. And the ICER report, the most current ICER report, is the report that was used for the studies, for this current study that's on the table right now, for tariffs and crossings across the Kinnick Arm Bridge. And those numbers were 11% less than what the recent counts were done, and so And we realize, too, that not everybody participated in that either. And so I think there's another probably 10 or 15% hedge there. So when you look at the census numbers compared to that, we do have a large area out there, a lot of people that will use this bridge, and it's a huge, huge opportunity for our state. We'll only complement and continue to complement the state. So with that, we'll let the experts come up and answer your questions, Madam Chair, and I thank you for your time.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Newman. And Ken and Mike from Kubota, or did Rex, were you going to bring some more information to us? State your name and affiliation.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rex Shattuck, staff to Representative Newman.
Before you get started, I want the record to reflect that Representative Feige has joined us. Go ahead.
Thank you. Briefly, what I'd like to do is have the bill before us and walk through the couple amendments that are actually in the bill to set the context of the discussion. After that, we have several folks from Kubota who can probably answer more detailed questions than I, and so they're here as employees of the state to help us in understanding what will actually happen in this. First off, on page 2, line 17 through 20, we add to the existing statute the monetary obligations incurred by the authority under this partnership or contracts. This basically clarifies that the state is obligated to the annual lease payment. And that's what this is in there for. It's to clarify that that's what the state is obligated to, is the annual lease payment that will be made. On line, then we move to page 4, and on line 21, we see that the change, there's been a change from $500 million to $600. And so basically what takes place here is we see that there's an increase in the bonding authority from $500 million to $600 million. In the PAB, or private activity bonds, that the federal DOT authorizes, it authorizes a federal, or excuse me, it authorizes a government agency to pass those through to the private sector. What you see here is those are authorized at $600 million. We have them at 500, and so what we're basically doing is going to the $600 million that's authorized so that we can take full advantage of that. That's all that you see in that.
And I might add here that this is already in statute. Legislators before us realize the need for other routes in that area, and so they set up and put into statute Kubota so that they would go out working for the state. They're the state. They went out to try to find out what would be the best way to do this, and now they have come back, and this is what they found. So the state are the same. So go ahead.
Thank you, ma'am, for that clarification. On page 5, line 9, should the legislature make an appropriation, this section that's being added, as the chair pointed out, to existing statute establishes the mechanism by which that money would be managed. And for further detail on that, we have several people here that can really answer in depth those questions. And so finally, then we move on to page 6 and 7, and we're looking on page 6 from line 28 through 31, and on page 7, line 1 through line 5. And as you know, in the case of most infrastructure that the state may be involved in building roads, there is no property tax that is paid on those. And so likewise, what this does is this clarifies that and says this bridge, when it's built, even though it's operated by a private, is public, and consequently there is no property tax on it. And so in a nutshell, that's what the amendments we've made to this bill. And I would love to try and answer all the in-depth questions that you have, but we have some that are more here. We've brought some folks to testify and answer your questions.
Okay, thank you. Now, Kabata people, whoever you are, come forward and state your names and your affiliation for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and the committee. My name is Michael Foster, and I'm chair of the Kinnickarm Bridge and Toll Authority. I have with me Kevin Hemingway, who is our chief financial officer. He will follow up with many of the detailed questions that came up at the last committee hearing. Just to reiterate some of the comments that Representative Newman made and staff made is it is a public-private partnership that we are looking at. It is called an availability payment type partnership. And that's a term that's used in transportation. A lot of times in vertical structures is referred to as kind of a lease, and I think you heard Rex talk about a lease payment. They're kind of one and the same, but through a public-private partnership, the one that we are engaged in or pursuing is that the private partner is responsible for the design, the build, and the operating of the facility. He's responsible for all the capital and operating costs to build and maintain that structure. And right now the terms that we're looking at is about a 35-year term. The structure of the facility or the infrastructure from the very beginning is owned by the state of Alaska. The private partner has the equity into it, and they get their equity back or return through their availability payment structure. The state of Alaska also owns the revenue that comes out of the toll. And so the state owns the structure, they own the revenue, and through the partnership, the private developer designs, builds, and operates it over the term of the course, and in return, the state provides an availability payment. Some of the things you'll see in the legislation and also what we've asked for appropriation, which I believe will go through the Finance Committee, is the ability to have that fund, that reserve fund, which sits in the Department of Revenue. It does not sit with Kabata or DOT. It sits with the Department of Revenue. And that reserve fund is there to cover shortages, which we know in the initial years the toll will not be sufficient enough to pay for the availability payments. The reserve is there. Once the toll is at a point, then that pays back into the reserve, and at some point in time, the reserve can sunset back or return or be used for other transportation projects outside of the Kinnickarm crossing. At this point, I'd like to go ahead and let Mr. Hemingway go ahead and address some of the specific points that the committee had and the public had at the last hearing.
Thank you, Mike, and through the chair and to the committee. My name is Kevin Hemingway. I'm the CFO of the Kinnickarm Bridge and Toll Authority, or Kabata. At the close of the hearing on March 10th, Chair Wilson requested that Kabata respond to Mr. Jamie Kenworthy's testimony provided at that hearing. I've summarized our response into four general themes rather than try to hit them point by point. First, traffic and toll revenue. Mr. Kenworthy testified that the committee should believe the cost estimates, but that you should not believe the revenue estimates because they were based on population forecasts that were 50 and 64% higher than those prepared by the Institute of Social and Economic Research, ICER, in December 2009, and by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development in December of 2010, respectively. Mr. Kenworthy misrepresented to you the population forecast figures used by Wilbur Smith Associates to update their traffic and toll revenue work. That work was completed in February of 2011, just 1 month ago, at the request of Kabata. The results of that update are reflected in the toll revenue forecast and the pro forma plan of finance that you have on page 6. As cited on page 11 of the Wilbur Smith Associates report, they relied primarily on the ICER 2009 population forecast and reviews it against the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development December 2010 forecast and another forecast provided by Woods and Poole, a private socioeconomic forecasting firm. All three population forecasts correlate very closely. They have proven already to be conservative. Just last week, the Census Bureau released the 2010 population count data by county for Alaska. Of course, we have boroughs up here, but they group us as counties nationwide. The ICER forecast for 2010 for the Mat-Su borough is nearly 9,000 below the census count, or an 11% understatement, as mentioned by Representative Newman. And for Anchorage, it is nearly 3,000 below the census count. So we're over 11,000 below in the ICER forecast already versus the actual headcount that was conducted by the Census Bureau for 2010.
Okay, now I would like to interrupt right here just to, so the one statement that said that our numbers weren't correct, now we know that they're in fact under what the actual population is because we just got the census report. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you. Go on.
A second point that Mr. Kenworthy brought up was negative amortization and balloon payments. He testified to you that the negative amortization and balloon payments were red flags that the committee should be concerned about. Under the public-private partnership structure, neither the state, Kibata, the Alaska Department of Transportation, or any other subdivision of the state will be the borrower of the private partner's debt or responsible for its repayment. Mr. Kenworthy mentioned capital appreciation bonds, or CABs. CABs only represent 5% of the hypothetical capital structure of the private partner that's presented in that pro forma financial plan. That plan was prepared for Kibata by Citigroup, our financial advisor. The pro forma plan is largely from the perspective of the private partner and was prepared as part of the due diligence to get a sense of what to expect or what the state should expect for availability payment proposals from the private sector. CABs are typically used to some extent in this type of project finance throughout the world, and I'm very familiar with that kind of a structure from my 25-year career in the private sector in finance. Again, I reiterate that the state will not be the borrower of or responsible for any debt of the private partner under the public-private structure. Our obligation is the annual payment that we agree to if we enter into a contract under based on the competitive process and proposals received. A third item that was brought up, pardon me, go ahead.
Let's stop right here then, and I want to make sure that all the members realize what you just said. And if I heard you right, you're saying that the state, which is Kibata and us here, and the other partner, is the partner is going to borrow the money, is going to build it and run it. And so we're not responsible for any of that. The state isn't, because that's totally between the borrower and whoever he borrows the money from. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And the money that we're looking at is because we own the bridge, the state, because the state would own the bridge, the state, I hope I say this right now, the state is leasing out the bridge. I'm not sure I understand that part of it. Can you?
It's kind of like having a property manager. The property manager, after the bridge is built, operates it. We call it a concession. They're responsible for maintaining it to the criteria that we, the state, set.
Okay.
If they fail to perform, we certainly have contractual arrangements or contractual conditions that allow us to remedy a situation, maintenance, or an operation issue. So it's their capital to design, build, and operate. You know, that's where they have their investment into it. The availability payment is just that. It's the state's responsibility to pay them for their investment. However, the ownership of it is always the state. Even you know, once we take final completion of it, the asset belongs to the state. In some respects, it's kind of like a vertical structure where you have a property management company may take care of all the tenants and operation and maintenance of the building. Someone else owns it, and they pay them for that service. So in this respect, it's very similar to that. We have somebody who, after it's built, we have somebody who operates it. It just happens to be the same private partner.
Okay, so we own the building, and we're going to be paying someone else to run and maintain the building, and as where does the payment for the state's paying for the bridge? How does that come in? Or does that where does that come in at?
The payment for the state paying for the bridge.
Yeah.
That's the availability payment, and in fact, the state doesn't make a payment to the private partner until the bridge is up and functional. When the bridge is functional, ribbon cutting, traffic starts, then the state has a requirement on an annual basis to make a payment to them. Call it an availability payment, call it a lease payment, call it a property management payment, but it's that payment which is paid to the private sector partner for designing building and then for operating it. And right now it's kind of a 35-year window that we're looking at. And then at the end of 35 years, they're done, the contract's over. At that point, you can enter into another concession where you have somebody operate it, or the state can just take over the operation and maintenance of it.
Okay.
So it is strictly just a payment for their investment in designing it, building it, and operating it.
Okay, and that was Mike Foster that was answering that question.
Yeah. Sorry about that.
When you guys change, your voices sound a little bit the same, so if you would say your name, that would help the gal back there that's going to be transcribing.
Thank you.
And let the record show that Representative Gruenberg has joined us. Go ahead. Number three.
This is Kevin Hemingway, through the chair. The third item that Mr. Kenworthy brought up was the risk of bankruptcy and whether that would impact the state. That's bankruptcy of the private partner. He implied that the bankruptcy of the private partner would reflect on the state's credit rating and that the state could be responsible for the private partner's debts and other obligations. He cited SR 125, that's a toll road in the San Diego area of Southern California that was built under a public-private partnership. The private partner recently filed for bankruptcy because that area of the country has had about 20% foreclosure rates and about 20% unemployment because of the depressed economy. The simple fact is that neither the state of California nor any public political subdivision of the state of California has incurred any additional costs resulting from the bankruptcy. The government expressly has no liability for the private partner's debt or other obligations, and that would also be the case with the Connect Arm Crossing project under the structure that we're discussing. In the case of SR 125, the state receives and owns a fully functioning, well-built, and maintained toll road, and the private partners and their lenders are working out the bankruptcy with no impact on the state's credit. The only potential impact on the state's credit rating would be if it failed to make the annual payment to the private partner. And toll revenue, conservatively forecast, is expected to cover those payments by about 1.5 times over the 35 years of operations under the planned agreement. And by the way, to add to Mike's comments, toll revenue is the primary source of that annual payment. And that toll revenue is owned by the state and collected either by the state or on our behalf by the private partner.
Okay. Any questions so far? The answer to that is the way it's set up, that the state would absolutely be not liable at all for any kind of bankruptcy that the partner would take.
That's correct, provided that it was for any cause other than our failure to make the annual payments.
Okay.
That would reflect on our credit rating, even though it would not be a legal obligation of the state.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you. In the first years of the payoff, the first 10 years, there's a cumulative deficit. Is that the responsibility of the state?
There is another bill that is out, HB 159, that appropriates money into the reserve account. We are running, on the base case forecast, a deficit. That reserve is to cover that, and then it is made up in the further years and then ultimately built up to the $1.56 billion forecast, and that's reflected, I guess, on the next page, page 7. If you'll look at that deficit and how that flows across to page 7, and when approximately year 10, we hit break even, and then from there the project begins to generate surplus that over the 35 years totals the $1.56 billion.
Okay, and do you want to follow up?
That's fine.
Okay, and so what I'm thinking on this is you know that ahead of time, and that's all in the plan, and that's why there's actually two bills that go with this project. One bill is the money part, and that went to finance, and then this bill, because it was the bridge itself, came here to transportation. And Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a very complicated subject. I'm not an expert in it, and I'm going to just ask you some questions. As a family lawyer. You've given us the best case scenario. What's the worst case scenario from the state's point of view?
The absolute worst case, through the chair, this is Kevin Hemenway, would be zero traffic on the bridge. I think that's an implausible outcome. The population forecast has historically been our growth has been very large in the area and is projected to continue to be so. The base case traffic forecast, and that is not the high case or the low case, it's the base case, so it is not the most optimistic forecast. It's the most probable in the estimation of the traffic and revenue forecasters, covers that annual payment over the 35 years by a factor of 1.5 times. If you take the inverse of that, that means that the traffic would have to average below 67% of the base case forecast before there would be any appropriation risk to the state.
May I continue?
Yes, I just want to stop here just a second, and then I'll let you continue. So based on the population that you used, and now we find that the population is actually 11% higher than that, that brings the probability of a problem down. Correct in my thoughts on that?
Chair, this is Mike Foster, and you're absolutely correct. Is the census numbers show that the ICER numbers were about 11% below the actual 2010 census. So as population grows, certainly the numbers become higher. The numbers that we have in our projections is what we consider to be the medium probability. You know, it isn't best case, it isn't worst case. To address a little further, the question is, what's the worst case scenario for the state? Well, of course, the worst case scenario is nobody ever drives across it, and the state has to pay out, and, you know, to be very honest, the total availability payment's a little over $3 billion over the course of 35 years. That's zero traffic, and that would be the state's commitment to basically leasing that building or paying for that bridge. Conversely, as Mr. Hemenway said, it's about a 67% if our growth in traffic is 33% less than what we have predicted, 33% less, then it's a break even. It's pretty much a break even. What that means is the state gets built in a facility operated for 35 years without having to put a dollar into it, and they didn't make a dollar out of it. So they got, you know, just say for simple terms, $1 billion worth of infrastructure, and they didn't pay for it, and it was worst case, but they also didn't get any revenue out of it, okay? But in year 35, if you look at some of the numbers where our availability payment goes away, then all of a sudden, even at that 33% reduction, worst case, in my opinion, 33% reduction in year 36, all of a sudden that delta, which you were paying out an availability payment in year 35, doesn't have to be made in year 36, and that now becomes the revenue to the state.
Okay, and because this is so complicated, I want to go one step at a time to make sure we all understand what we're talking about. Representative Grunberg, you had another question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That is the amount we would have to pay for the initial construction. Let's look at some of the other costs. How about the costs of maintenance? How much would that be? And who would pay that?
Through the chair, Representative Gruber, the cost of O&M, operation and maintenance of the facility, is part of that availability payment.
I see.
And so the payment that we make to the private developer is to design it, to build it, and in our scenario for 35 years, operate and maintain the structure or concession.
May I continue?
Yes.
We have a bridge now, hypothetically, and we have roads in Anchorage, but we don't have the proper roads in the Mat-Su. How much more are we going to pay for them?
Well, there is additional infrastructure that goes with growth. And whether the growth happens with the bridge or without the bridge, there's still growth and there's still additional infrastructure. So the question is, and I'm sure that Mr. Odison with DOT can address this a little better than I can, But outside of the Kibata project boundaries, there is improvements or additional infrastructure that will be built in order to not only to support the bridge, but to support that growth that we are seeing. And whether the growth is happening with an expansion of the Glen, or is happening with a bypass of Wasilla or additional infrastructure, there will be growth, there will be need for capital, and there will be need for additional infrastructure. The bridge is not creating the additional infrastructure. It is the growth that's creating additional infrastructure.
And we will have Jeff Otteson will be when Kibata gets done, we'll have Jeff Otteson come up, and you can ask him any question you would like. So continue.
Yeah, just so the folks know, I'm going to be interested in knowing how much that will be and how much specifically the state's portion of that. Okay. And you're suggesting I ask Mr. Otteson.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative, I believe that Mr. Otteson with DOT can give you probably a much better handle on the projections on this, on what's required in the STIP and where the state's going.
May I continue, please?
Yes.
Again, as a conservative person from the state's point of view, I want to be sure we're protected from the state taxpayers as much as possible. What is the risk, since we're all very sensitive to things like tsunamis and earthquakes and stuff like that, what is the risk of potential damage to the structure? How much would that likely cost, and who would pay?
Through the chair, Representative Groomberg.
Name. Your name.
Oh, Michael Foster. I thought you were asking me your name. I thought the chair sufficed, but okay. Michael Foster again. There's always risk with acts of God, seismic events, tsunamis. You know, we've seen that recently. Those that have lived up here in 64 remember those days, mm-hmm. and remember the impacts to our existing infrastructure. You know, frankly, as an engineer, I'm an engineer, a 30-year engineer. I mean, you can design stuff, but when it happens, you know, things happen. And the bridge will be seismically designed. That's probably one of the biggest criteria to the structure itself. People have asked about ice pans and ice loading, mm-hmm. Horizontal loading.
But I'm including that
but
in
seismic
my
is actually the controlling factor. A lot of folks have asked, well, how can you build a bridge across mud-laden Cook Inlet? Well, the mud is really on the edges. The actual area where the foundation is consolidated till, glacial consolidated till. And in layman's term, that's like nature's concrete. Very, very structurally sound foundation. So the foundation, the design of the structure will meet all the applicable codes to withstand seismic and acceleration and also tsunami wave loading or lateral loading, which is ice or water. And in fact, worst case in a tsunami is a winter event where you also have a wave plus the impact of ice. Mm-hmm. And so you go through all the engineering. And in some respects, speaking as an engineer, the engineering part of it's easy. The finance part is the hard part. Mm-hmm. You know, if it was just designing the bridge, I could probably do that without a whole lot of effort. It's getting through all the other aspects of it. But it is and will be designed and built to the current or best standards to mitigate a seismic event or an acceleration event, tsunamis, and other factors that may be induced.
Okay, may I please follow up?
Follow up, Representative Groomberg.
And I guess this is for both of you gentlemen. I mean, I don't know who to ask this. Most of these I don't know, so just whoever wants to. Is the structure insurable, or is the state going to be a self-insurer on this? How will that work?
As I said, finance.
Representative Groomberg, through the chair. This is Kevin Hemingway. I'm the chief financial officer. The terms of the contract will require the private partner to carry insurance for routine insurable events, force majeure events beyond a certain cap, like earthquake or seismic or perhaps a volcanic event. We have four or five volcanoes in sight right across the inlet. Would be a responsibility, I think, that would not be transferred to the private sector simply because they're uninsurable events. Mm. and those would routinely be retained by the public, and we have those same risks with all of our public infrastructure across the state today. The one thing I will say is because this is a modern structure with more modern engineering, it will be built to a much higher standard than a lot of our legacy infrastructure. And today, we only have a single way in and out of Anchorage or between Anchorage and Points North. And this structure would be much more likely to withstand a seismic event than the existing crossing. So if we ever have a safety or emergency issue, having two routes, hopefully one or both of which would withstand any kind of act of God, that we would be providing much better safety factor for our citizens.
Yeah, with one more
Representative Gruden.
I appreciate your letting me do this, but I think it's important that we, both sides of the aisle, get to ask their stuff. Do you have a seismic report? I'm not sure I'm using the right term, but a report of some kind on the bridge as designed and what the chances are for various types of disasters and how this is. What the risks? I need to know what the risks are. It's like buying a house. You want an engineering report. Do you have something like that?
Chair. This is Mike Foster, and through the chair, Representative Grimberg. Yes, we do have. You know, we're our design into the crossing or the type of foundation is pretty far along. There is seismic. A lot of that is required by code. We have done the and actually in a seismic event, speaking as an engineer, it isn't the seismic event that is critical. It's the acceleration factor. And the acceleration factor is how fast the wave propagates. And in 64, as you know, we had a very fast wave, and the wave had a rebound wave, and it just kept going and going. And in a lot of respects, that's what they saw in Japan recently. It isn't always the magnitude as it is the acceleration of it. And as we go through and we design this and our private partner actually finalizes the design, because, again, we're going to rely on them or put some of the onus on them to meet our design criteria, and they're going to have to design it and build it. So they have the value to do some value engineering, and certainly we have the responsibility to review and approve that. But it will be... best available engineering methods that will look at it. To answer your specific question is we have geotechnical, we have tidal, we have ice, and we have seismic that we use in order to model it. But that would be no different than the Port of Anchorage or Point McKenzie or any bridge structure on the Glen Highway or bridge structure across the Tanana River. They all go through the same seismic type reviews.
May I follow up briefly?
Just a second. And
let him do one more.
Okay. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you. It's more of a request than a question. At some point, will you be sending a copy of that or some kind of an objective summary of it to the legislature? Because I'd like to take a look at it, and maybe some of the other folks around here would too.
Through the chair, Mike Foster again, and we can certainly provide that to this committee or to your office or. We'll send it to the chair, and the chair can send it out. But we certainly can provide that information. It depends on how much book space you have, how much you want to see, because some of these are pretty extensive, or we can just kind of do an abstract.
Yes,
of
the chair.
Of water factor.
I want an executive summary with citations if I need to get into it. But it won't be read if it's anything very big. Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And then give it to me, and I will get to the rest of them. Representative Peterson, you had a question?
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to go back to the population estimates. Looking at the Matsu Borough, not everyone who is moving to the Matsu Borough is going to be using this bridge. There are people who are on the east side of the Matsu Borough would have to drive significantly further to use this bridge to come into Anchorage than they would to use the Glen Highway. So one would have to assume that they are not going to drive further and pay $5 each way on a bridge when they can drive a shorter distance and it'll cost them less. So have you broken down these population figures in, say, the east or the west side of the Matsu Borough to see how many people would actually legitimately it would be advantageous for them to take the bridge?
Through the chair to Representative Peterson, this is Kevin Hemingway. Our traffic and revenue consultants look at the studies by what they call traffic analysis zones, and they're sort of small areas within the borough. I think there's, in the total study area for the model, and this is not an exact number, but there is something like 90 traffic analysis zones between Anchorage and the MAPSU. It's a very large number, so they're looking at very small areas. And they look at the current population and what the population and households and employment by each of those zones will be with and without the project. Today, the majority of the borough population lives at the first available place up the existing road, which is the Glen Highway, and that's in the Palmer-Wasilla area. More recently, the growth in the MAPSU borough has been in the Kinnick-Fairview area, which is along Kinnick-Goose Bay Road, south of Wasilla and west of Wasilla, and in the South Big Lake area. Today, the Kinnick-Fairview area has a higher absolute population than the combined incorporated areas of Palmer and Wasilla. It's true that people in Palmer and Wasilla will not likely use the bridge because the people in Wasilla are indifferent in terms of distance, so the toll becomes a friction. And so the point where you pick up the existing population is going to be south and west of basically the west side of Wasilla. It'll pick up a big part of that Kinnick Fairview and South Big Lake. But that's why the traffic starts out relatively low. In the base case forecast, Wilbur Smith Associates predicted about 7,000 trips a day. That's about 3,500 round trips. I think the actual number was 6,700. But that grows over time, and this is a 35-year concession agreement, and for the state, this is a 100-year asset. And as our chairman, Mr. Foster, mentioned earlier, the need for the infrastructure is a factor of growth. The current transportation network in the region, since Anchorage is out of land and housing prices are so much higher in Anchorage versus the MAPSU, is promoting the population to grow on the first available piece of road to the north because there's nowhere to go to the east, south, or west without a crossing in place. Conversely, the people living in the MAPSU work in Anchorage because the average wages, according to the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development, are about a third higher in Anchorage than they are in the MAPSU, and that's resulted in a situation where about 44% of the MAPSU workforce commutes to or through Anchorage to work, and that includes North Slope workers and fishing industry, et cetera, the people who commute through Anchorage. So the existing population will still predominantly use the existing transportation network. They will receive some benefit, though, because there will be lower congestion on that route from the traffic that is west and south of Wasilla that will use the bridge. And the bridge will promote urban infill with that future population growth because they'll be able to buy affordable housing closer to the better jobs that are in Anchorage because it's the economic hub of the state with oil and gas and the airport and all the other things that attract workforce to Anchorage.
Do you have a follow-up? One follow-up.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I was looking back at another project that the state did about 20 years ago, and that was the tunnel to Whittier. And they had projected that it would take less than 10 years for the traffic on that tunnel to get to the point where they would have a break-even point. And so the tolls would cover the cost of that. We're at close to 20 years since that tunnel has been put through, and the traffic figures are actually 50% of the original projection. And so I'm just really not necessarily believing your projections of actually how many people use the bridge. I know the retailers in downtown Anchorage have had trouble getting people to drive to downtown Anchorage to shop just because people don't want to pay the parking meter. So paying $5 each way to go across a bridge I don't know whether Alaskans will do that. And especially if they could, if they have a vehicle that gets high mileage, it still might be less expensive for them to drive even a longer distance to come into Anchorage on the Glen Highway.
Through Chair, this is Mike Foster again, representing Peterson. One, I live in Anchorage, and to me, the issue isn't necessarily willingness to pay for a parking meter as it is the ability to find a parking meter in Anchorage. And so a lot of it is more, I don't really believe it's an issue of whether, because when you park at the airport, you pay. When you park downtown, you pay. There's parking garages. It's a user fee type infrastructure or user fee type revenue. It typically doesn't go to buy more parking meters. It goes to pay for other type services. The Whittier Tunnel, and I assume Mr. Otteson might be able to address that a little further, but having some quite a bit of familiarity with that project, this is unlike what we're looking at, where we're seeing a significant growth in the MATSU and the South Central area. We know what the projections are, that Knik Goose Bay was the fastest growing area of the MATSU borough. We know that folks are in Anchorage, or, you know, when I moved from Fairbanks down to Anchorage in sometime in late 70s, or it might have been 80, you know, there wasn't a lot in Eagle River. The old Glen was there, Peters Creek, Aklutna, and you've seen that progression, and you've seen, you know, now it moves around the Knik arm and Wasilla. So the growth is happening. With regards to the comparison to the Whittier Tunnel, there are really two different distinct projects. One is, we open the tunnel, they will come. It's a Kevlin-Cosner effect. You build it, they will come. In this case, they are already coming. They're already there. And what this will do is provide that link and additional infrastructure. And Representative Newman leaned over my shoulder and said, don't forget the commercial traffic leaving out of the Port of Anchorage, going across the crossing, going north to other locations in the interior and into Prudhoe on the Dalton. That traffic going north doesn't come through Anchorage. It reduces the wear and tear in town, reduces the wear and tear in the Glen. You know, when you start looking at the economics of how this one structure would also relieve some of the O&M costs and capital costs related to the Glen expansion, related to a Wasilla bypass or stuff, you know, they start to become almost a balance. But there is a tremendous amount of commercial traffic that would be going north out of the Port of Anchorage. And there would also be the question of a lot of development in Anchorage. They have a lot of gravel needs. Right now it comes by rail, comes from a Clutinus pit, comes from other pits in the Palmer-Wasilla area. You'd probably see a lot of commercial traffic coming in through that direction with gravel sources on the west side of the inlet. So in addition to just the passenger traffic, there is a pretty substantial commercial traffic. I hope I hit all your points there.
One follow-up.
Follow-up, Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You brought up the Port of Anchorage, and so that makes me think about the expansion of the port at Port McKenzie. And I know that there's talk about extending a rail down to the port, and that would be for commercial uses mostly. And so would that lessen the number of vehicles going across the bridge if the Port of McKenzie was developed?
Through the Chair, Mike Foster, again, Representative Peterson, is the Port of Anchorage is predominantly a freight port. Governor Sheffield has done a good job of developing that. That is really the lifeline of Alaska for freight. The Point McKenzie is currently being developed is more of a resource-type port. So the freight that still comes in by container ship will still go north using the Knik crossing as the most viable northern bound route. The addition of to rail to there is rail being the loop is being built at Point McKenzie. There is a request for funding and stuff for the spur, and so the rail is moving, and I would probably say more likely the rail will eventually connect to Point McKenzie, which is a resource port. is my opinion that the two are really not in competition, and what this crossing will actually do is complement both of the port facilities.
Okay, thank you. And I think we've got one more point to go to yet.
Representative Wilson, this is Kevin Hemingway. I think the last point that we'd like to cover is the comments about unlimited government guarantee, which Mr. Kenworthy implied to this committee would be the result of HB 158. The estimate of the total availability payments over 35 years, as our chairman Mike Foster mentioned, is $3.2 billion. While that's a large number, it's certainly not unlimited. Mr. Kenworthy, though, fails to mention that the base case toll revenue forecast that is predicated on the ICER 2009 population forecast base case generates about $1.56 billion of surplus over the 35 years of operations in excess of the annual payment total. Some of that surplus would be used to pay for some of the infrastructure extensions that are within the project by Kibata, with the rest of it being available to cover other infrastructure needs around the state.
How much was it?
$1.56 billion. The project itself, though, is a 75 to 100-year asset that the state will have full control of after the end of the public-private partnership. And over the first 60 years, that's about 25 years after the annual payments cease, it's projected to generate about $10 billion of surplus. That can cover a lot of those infrastructure needs as the state grows. Additionally, the language of HB 158 simply makes the implicit moral obligation of the state to a contractual commitment explicit. It doesn't change the legal status of the obligation, because no legislature can obligate a future legislature, and any such commitment would always be subject to appropriation under the Alaska Constitution. But what it does make, what it does do is make that moral obligation explicit to the private sector. And the private sector gets some comfort out of that, and that gets reflected in the interest rates that they will provide, that the lenders will provide to our private partner, and the equity returns that our private partner will expect on their equity in the project, which is estimated to be about 10% of the total cost in terms of the capital structure. What that results in is a lower cost to the state, because through the competitive procurement process, the teams that are competing to be the private partner with the state will sharpen their pencils, and those lower interest rates will be reflected in the proposals we receive in terms of annual availability payments.
Okay. So what I'm hearing you say is that at the most it would be $3.2 billion. However, there would be more than likely an excess of $1.56 billion, which would give us what we would end up really in the first 35 years, it would be $1.64 billion. And then over the rest of the time, we would be bringing in about $10 billion. Is that correct?
To the chair, this is Mike Foster, and you're absolutely correct. The availability payment based on our model, and of course we haven't gone out for solicitation, so we don't know, you know, we don't have the actual proposals in hand. This is our consultant's view of the P3 process, the information, and what they think the availability payments will be more than likely at. And so there is a roughly, it was an estimate of about $3.2 billion in payments the state will have to make over this 35-year agreement. Based on our base case traffic model, there will be a little over $1.5 billion excess above that availability payment that will be able to be used for project or for statewide infrastructure. On year 36, the availability payment is gone. In year 36, on the model that we have, the state has the requirement of doing the operation and maintenance. We no longer have a payment. It's like having a house and all of a sudden you paid it off. You know, your equity starts increasing exponentially, and that's where over the course of this 60-year model, the state actually sees a little over $10 billion in return or net revenue over and above availability payments, O&M costs after the concession is over.
Okay. Thank you. And if we had to do it, if the state was going to just build the bridge right now, we would have to put out the money right now or within the next few years to build the bridge. And if I understand right, the state doesn't start any of that until the bridge is built, which would take 3 to 5 years. Is that correct?
Chair, this is Mike Foster again. The state's payment, the availability payment, isn't made until the structure is open for operation. It's like building a building. You don't pay your first tenant lease until you're moved into it. And so if in your scenario the state was to build it on their own, which is always a possibility, the state would have to design capital, put up the capital and build it, and then they'd have to operate it. In this case, it's a private-public partner arrangement, and the private sector is putting up the capital and also taking the risk for construction delays or overruns. The state doesn't have any liability for any construction cost issues unless we are the cause of that delay.
Okay. Fine. Thank you very much. And I don't see any other questions, so thank you. Oh, Representative Feige has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let's see. Let's go to page 4 on the bill, section 2. It starts at line 8, where it says AS 1975-211A is repealed and reenacted to read. It's always interesting to go back and see what was taken out of a particular paragraph. What is in the bill is essentially the first part of what of the original paragraph. And let me quote out of the record what was removed, or out of the original statute. And I quote, "Before issuing bonds for the Kinnick Arm Bridge, the authority shall submit to the State Bond Committee a description of the bond issue and a preliminary prospectus offering circular or official statement relating to the bond issue. Bonds may not be issued unless the State Bond Committee finds, based upon the information submitted by the authority under this section and under and other information that is reasonably available to committee, that the Kinnick Arm Bridge revenue and other revenue available to the authority can be reasonably expected to be adequate for payment of the principal of and interest on the bonds to be issued, and that issuance of the bonds by the authority would not be expected to adversely affect the ability of the state or its political subdivisions to market the bonds." Was that taken out?
And if I remember right, that were that because the partner is the borrower, with that in, there's no guarantee for the people that are loaning them the money that the state wouldn't halt it. And so this is giving the partner the better terms so that he will get the loan from someone else. And if I am wrong in that statement, correct me, please, someone.
Representative Feige through Chair Wilson. This is Kevin Hemingway. Whether that language stays in or not is in a way mooted, because the authority is not intending to issue bonds other than as a conduit issuance of private activity bonds that the private partner would be the borrower, not the state. The issue that should be of concern for the state is the process that is gone through to accept a contract or accept a proposal and enter into a contract, because the passage of these bills creates no obligations of the state. Entering into that contract does. And the process that is established is under current state procurement law, and the governance of the authority and the wisdom of the legislature established under AS 19.75 is comprised of the Commissioner of Revenue, the Commissioner of DOT, three public members appointed by the governor for staggered five-year terms, and two state legislators, one from the House and one from the Senate. And that, under the authority statutes, is where the powers and duties are vested, and that includes entering into contract. Further, the rigorous procurement process will include participation from the Attorney General's office, more as at a different level on an advisory basis, the Department of Revenue and the Department of Transportation, as well as our outside consultants. And the authority has a fiduciary responsibility and our board to the state to ensure that a bad contract is not entered into. So whether that language is in there or not, I think from the authority standpoint, is somewhat moot. It would certainly be protective in the event that there was bonds issued by the authority where the state was the borrower or other debt instruments, but the plan structure does not anticipate any debt on the books of the state. It was simply the contractual obligation to make the annual payments under the public-private agreement that is really subject, the level of which is a maximum is what's proposed by the private partner, and the amount can be reduced if they're underperforming under the contract term. So I think you have to look to what the rigorous procurement process is and the way that the governance of the authority is established and what the fiduciary responsibility that we as state employees and our board as stewards of a state project have in making that determination on the contract. But I certainly, for one, would not object if that language was in there or not. I think it's somewhat mooted by the type of transaction that we're pursuing.
Through the chair, this is Mike Foster. If I could add a little bit to that, to Representative Feige's question is it really allows us when we go out for the private partner solicitation to give them assurance, and really what it is borrow money and issue and refund bonds, and it has to do with the three items below, which is the gross revenue and the revenue received, and then also through state appropriation. And it's an assurance to the private partner that the availability payments will be made. And if through the revenue, if Kubota needs to borrow or something to make those availability payments or come back to the legislature, this is what this change in the language is addressing, is that assurance or security to our private partner that the availability payments, which is will be made, and that's in the best interest of the state because we should get the best terms when they give us their proposal for a payment.
Okay. All right. Thank you, gentlemen, very much. And we will next. Let's have Jeff Otteson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Otteson, the Director of Program Development in the Department of Transportation. And I'd like to start, I think, by picking up the question that Representative Ruhmberg asked about how much would it cost for all the other road work in the region. We've done a little bit of analysis of that. I think, as Mike Foster said, the bridge doesn't create the traffic. The traffic is created by the population growth that's going on in both Anchorage and Mat-Su. So you're going to need to fund a lot of road work in the future with or without this bridge. That's just a given. When we looked at the Anchorage long-range transportation plan and the Mat-Su long-range transportation plan, and we add those numbers up and annualize them through 2035, we come up with about $69 million a year needed in Anchorage and about $20 million a year needed in Mat-Su on an annualized basis. Currently, in the past 2 years, just in Anchorage alone, the legislature has funded about $100 million to Anchorage, not in federal funds, but in state funds. This is not even looking at the federal side of the equation. So that amount of money is already occurring. That amount of vesting is already taking place. But, of course, it needs to go on for a long time as we continue to build improvements to the grid in Anchorage and now in Mat-Su, widening the Parks Highway, widening KGB Road, et cetera. I think the difference with and without the bridge is this. With the bridge, the first $500 million, maybe $600 million to build the bridge comes from bonds sold by the firm that builds the bridge and paid for by the users. So you've added $600 million that's not on the state's books to the region's transportation resources. And you're picking up a lot of traffic with that $600 million that doesn't otherwise have to be picked up. The other thing that happens is as you get out in the years, as the project grows and the demand for traffic grows, it's obligated to build some additional links, in particular the link between the bridge and over to the Seward Glen corridor. That connection is an obligation of the Kubota project and needs to be paid by their toll revenue. So it's more than the initial $500 to $600 million that's being brought to the table by Kubota. It's several, at least $100 million more for that project. Finally, as Mr. Hemingway said, as you get out in time and the project is producing surplus revenue, that surplus revenue under the agreement with Federal Highway Administration has to be spent on highway and other highway-related improvements in the state of Alaska, subject to appropriation by the legislature. And so that becomes a third source of revenue that there is not to be accounted for without the bridge. So the bridge really brings a lot of benefit to the region and to the state in terms of dollars that would not otherwise be available other than appropriation from the general fund.
Okay. Representative Pruitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you tell me, if we were to expand the Glen Highway, how much would that cost?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, it's about $5 million a lane mile. And that brings up the question of traffic analysis. Both Highway to Highway project, which is a state-led project, and the Kubota project have done traffic predictions on the two main corridors, the bridge and the Glen Highway leading out of town of Anchorage. Actually, the Highway to Highway estimate is a little higher on both corridors. They're very close. They're 36 and 37,000 across the bridge by the year 2035. But the Highway to Highway had predicted that the Glen Highway would be about 6,000 cars higher than the bridge has. So if anything, Kubota has got a slightly more conservative estimate. They've not been quite so generous in their estimating of traffic, but they're quite similar in the overall number. As I understand it, you're going to have to widen the Glen, but you might get away with a two-lane widening with the bridge, whereas you're going to need a four-lane widening without the bridge. So there's still a savings there to the state, and that... And as you know, every other bridge in the region, or excuse me, every other road in the region is going to come from a source that is either federal or state GF, not from borrowed money paid for by tolls.
Any idea how much it would?
Follow up, Representative Pruitt.
Thank you. Anyhow, any idea how much it would cost to widen that road, though? If we were to make it the four lane, like you mentioned, four lane widen, I mean, right now we couldn't do that. We'd have to build all new overpasses. Which
yes.
would be, I know we're getting somewhere between 50 to 100 million to affect the. We have an overpass at Muldoon and the Glen Highway. That's just one overpass.
Right.
We're talking about multiple overpasses. How much would it cost if we had to expand the Glen Highway because we didn't have traffic going through Kubota Bridge?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, it's approximately 40 miles from downtown Anchorage to downtown Wasilla. So that would be 80 lane miles to build two more lanes. Times $5 million a mile would be about $400 million. That does not include major bridges and major interchange improvements, so it goes higher than that.
Follow up,
Representative.
We've already talked a little bit about the growth that's going on in West Wasilla. We heard a comment on a bypass around Wasilla. How much would that cost?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, the last numbers I've seen are in the order of $250 million, $250 million.
Can you tell me?
Follow up.
Current traffic on the Glen, is it at capacity? Is it over capacity?
Through through the chair, Representative Pruitt. I don't know that exactly. It's getting close to capacity. It's certainly at times, I think it's reaching capacity. You assume about 5,000 cars per lane mile. No, excuse me, 10,000 cars per lane. So we're in the high 30s, and you've got four lanes out there, so you're looking at about 37,000 cars a day. You're approaching that 40,000 number, which would be capacity.
And then one last question.
Representative Pruitt.
How many roads or bridges in Alaska do we get revenue from?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, we get revenue from the Whittier Tunnel only. It only covers part of the operating cost.
So last question. So there are no bridges out there right now that have recouped the cost of initially building them.
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, that is correct. That's one of the unique aspects of this. This does not only bring its own money to the table, by the predictions you're seeing from the Kubota staff, it's predicted to bring extra revenue for the rest of the state's needs.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Fahey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the statements was that the, I don't remember the exact wording, but that the growth of the population is what's going to drive the bridge. If we build the bridge, looking at it as an overall system, the bridge is all fine and dandy, but then if it ends in a dirt road on the other side, that's not going to generate the toll revenue you need. So by building the bridge, we will also generate the requirement to build the additional roads to connect existing infrastructure on the other side. How much is that going to cost?
Through the chair, Representative Feige, that I believe is covered by, you have to build so much a year either way. The question will be is where do you have to build it? That with the bridge, you will be building different routes perhaps. Instead of widening the Glen to four lanes, new lanes, you might widen the two. But you'll undoubtedly need a connection between the bridge and going north to the Parks Highway, somewhere west of Wasilla. You don't want to take all that traffic back on KGB Road all the way up into downtown Wasilla and then start heading out the parks. The state already has a project at Vine Road, which is about halfway up KGB, to connect north to Parks Highway. But I would imagine eventually you will need another north-south connector somewhere closer to Big Lake.
With that in mind,
follow-up, Representative Feige.
Thank you, Paula. With that in mind, do we have right-of-ways secured on the far shore to connect roads to this bridge?
Through the chair, Representative Feige, the Vine Road is partially owned by the state, partially owned by the borough, so that right-of-way is secured, although it may need to be widened. But there's Burma Road, which, as you probably know, is a very substandard road at the moment. I'm sure it would need to be widened. But if you wanted to build a more direct route on, a new alignment, some people have even talked about following the railroad extension if that comes to pass. Those would all be new right-of-way. And there's really no way for the state to purchase right-of-way in advance unless we get an appropriation. We can't use federal money to do that. We've looked far and wide. How do we get proactive about right-of-ways? It's very difficult.
If I was the property owner on the far side, on the far shore, and you built this bridge with the assumption that you'd need roads on the other side, and you didn't already have the right-of-way, what do you think that does to the cost of the right-of-way?
Through the chair, Representative Feige, there's quite a process for buying right-of-way under the Uniform Relocation Act. We basically do an appraisal. We do a review appraisal. That is a second appraiser's opinion of the first. We negotiate what we believe is fair market value. If we reach impasse, we have the right to use eminent domain and go to the courts and have it adjudicated. So I don't want to trivialize it, because buying right-of-way is one of the most difficult things we do. But we buy right-of-way every day, and we buy right-of-way in front of major arterials with active traffic and active businesses. So this would still be sort of virgin territory, and it will be difficult, but it's certainly achievable. We do it all the time.
Follow-up, Representative Feige.
We have an estimate of what it's going to cost to purchase the right-of-ways.
Through the chair, Representative Feige. No, not specifically. We tend to include the cost of right-of-way in our cost of road estimation. In other words, it's one of the elements of the cost of the road. Okay.
Follow-up?
Nope.
Okay. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We had talked about one of the main groups that we're going to be using, potentially using this bridge, would be commercial vehicles, trucks heading north. And we've also talked about a rail extension down to the Port McKenzie area. Has the DOT or anyone looked at making this a railroad bridge? And what the cost of that might be in comparison to a highway bridge?
Through the chair, Representative Peterson, that might be better answered directly by the Kibata members, but my general understanding is it was looked at the possibility of co-locating it, but there were several technical difficulties. One of the things to bear in mind is that a railroad route, has different geometric standards for curves and grade than does a highway. Basically, highways can deal with steeper curves and tighter curves and steeper grades. And so you really have to then change the bridge alignment to serve both.
Is it?
Oh, I stand corrected. You may want to ask Mr. Foster to come up. It is. He tells me that it is now compatible for a rail alignment co-located on the bridge.
Madam Chairman, could we ask him to come up and possibly?
Thank you, Jeff. Unless you have anything else you want to add. All right. Why don't you come forward, and you're the expert in how this works. So
I'm not sure I'm the expert, but I have an answer, I believe. Through the chair, Mike Foster again, Representative Peterson, is the through the NEPA process, the environmental impact process, rail has or was considered, and the structure, the alignment is both vertically and horizontally compatible with rail, which means on the Port of Anchorage side, the grades, the curve, the bridge grade, everything would be compatible to adding rail. The structure itself is not structurally designed or built for rail to be added on the superstructure. That's not to say at some point in time the structure couldn't be added to, expanded to, another deck added to it. But our goal was the vehicular traffic across that. But the alignment, the embankment, the road surface, the curves, the grade is all rail compatible.
Representative Peterson, do you have a follow-up?
No, not right now.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. And we would like, is the someone from the Department of Revenue here? You wanted to make some comments? Okay, Representative Newman, come on.
Thank you, Madam Wilson and Chair. Just a few comments to add some information to some of the questions that have been asked. You know, somebody who's lived there for 30 years, I know my district. The bridge is designed, it's easier to build a railroad bridge if there's going to be one off of an existing bridge. So when you look at the way the railroad's designed right now, coming out of Anchorage, goes through Wasilla, it's a real pinch point in Wasilla. It's been a huge problem for Wasilla because you've got a lake on one side and a railroad and then a lake and a former governor in between. And so you've got to deal with those issues. Now, every time you have a railroad crossing, it's a very dangerous situation for the public. And in downtown Wasilla, it's one of the worst pinch points there is in the state. About 4 million cars, vehicles, travel from Wasilla, through the Big Lake a year. 4 million. You know, and trying to get them to there. And the railroad follows that same route. Now, if there's a different route for the railroad to go there through the freight, that's the best way to do it, because it's not safe the way they're doing it right now. They have to use reduced train speeds, train loads and stuff because of the existing facilities. aren't at capacity. They're, you know, as you know, Madam Chair, you've been very engaged in this discussion and in helping the railroad along with their upgrading to heavier gauge, single gauge lines, single rail lines, and the ability to do that. And so they're going to have to rebuild what they currently got to get to that point if they want to continue using freight down in through Anchorage. So when you add up all those expenses, including right-of-ways, as Representative Feige brought up, I'll say this, the Mansu Borough, because they are part owner of Vine Road. Now, there was bonds passed by the Mansu Borough recently, and the state was asked to pick up part of that. That didn't work. They want to come back with a 50-50 bond that typically is done through roads in the state, you know, on projects that are 50% state funded, 50% borough. So we're getting the Mansu Borough, the people who are on the north side, the North Shore, per se, to help pay for the construction of those road projects on that side instead of just the state carrying the full load on that. And believe me when I tell you, well, we've already lost three people on KGB. I'm tired of losing my constituents on these roads because of the congestion that we've got. We've got to build new construction. We have to have new roads. You know, the last estimate that we had presented by DOT at a public meeting that we held just after we lost a couple of the skates out there at KGB at Kinnick School about 6 weeks ago, Senator Huggins and I had a town hall meeting there, was $65 million to do KGB Road. That's right away, that's done, because we've already spent a lot of money on the engineering and getting that done. And those are in the state because it's the third day most dangerous highway in the state. From Wasilla to Big Lake, the most dangerous stretch of highway in the state, the deadliest highway in the state. We've been putting money into that. The last money was $13 million, $6 million for design and engineering, $7 million for right-of-way acquisitions. And we've already got a lot of the frontage roads in our Huggins. For the last 7 years, we've been putting money in anticipation of expansion of that road. So we've got frontage roads, you know, that are coming up to there that we've been, in the meantime, building up so that we don't have one huge expense at one time. We've been trying to pick off these things as we go along. They are in a step. For this, and that's the last estimate on that was $100 million to take care of that part. So the design engineering for a lot of those other roads on the North Shore are pretty much completed, and they're in a step ready to start moving forward on these. And to have, again, the opportunity to have this bridge that will help cover those costs and put money back into the state and help keep our property taxes down in the Mansu Borough all at the same time, I think is a wonderful opportunity for the state of Alaska, including Anchorage, to help cover their costs on that site too, which are part of the plan. So I hope that helps straighten out some of those costs on right-of-ways of the railroad and those expenditures to the state and all.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'm looking here. Do we have anybody from the Department of Revenue to make any comments? All right. Does anyone have any questions about the bonds or anything? Because we have someone that could answer questions, but if we don't have them, we can go on then. We'll go ahead and continue then with public testimony. And let's see. And we've got someone that traveled all the way to come here. So Susan DiPietro?
Good afternoon. My name is Suzanne DiPietro. I'm a resident of the Government Hill community in Anchorage and a member of their community council, and I'm speaking today on behalf of the community council. We in the Government Hill community have been following this project really from its very inception. It's been quite a while, 2003. And one of the impacts that I'd like to make you aware of that maybe you haven't been talking about too much in this meeting today, where we've been focusing a lot on finances, is the impact on our neighborhood, which will be quite severe. And the route that was chosen is going to come through our neighborhood. We're actually a pretty small neighborhood, about maybe 150 families on the side of the neighborhood where the first phase of the road would come through, that would connect to the bridge. And they would need to take right away, and it would include taking between 12 and 14 houses in our neighborhood. So Those are families who are going to be displaced, my neighbors, my friends. And so I just wanted to start off with that. The other thing that I'd like to say from a historical perspective, because we have been following this from the very beginning, is I have sat in many numerous meetings and heard presentations, more than I can count. And when this project was first presented, it was supposed to be that the private partner was going to bring the money to the table, that there was not to be any additional state funding. And we have said it over and over, and in fact, the AMATS committee in Anchorage made it a condition of the project's inclusion in the long-range transportation plan that no additional state money be appropriated to the project. Now we have before us the Kinnickarm Bridge and Toll Authority asking for $150 million just for starters of additional state money. They began this project with $110 million roughly of federal and state matching funds. And now they're asking for another $150 million deposit on these availability payments, which is really just the start. And in addition to that, they're asking for a state guarantee. And all the discussion, I guess I'm not exactly sure, after all the discussion, what exactly that guarantee that's in this bill before you obligates the state to do. But one thing I heard loud and clear is the state would be obligated to make those availability payments. And so the question becomes, $3.2 million of availability payments, we are responsible for making those payments. And we hope that toll revenues will defray some of those expenses. But the fact of the matter is, if this bill passes, I heard the Kibata representative say we would be obligated to contribute that amount of money one way or another. That's a lot of money. That's a big number. And it goes up over the years, and it's a long-term commitment. And I think, you know, thinking about what would happen if we move forward with this bill, the bridge would be built, we would have that infrastructure in place, and then let's just say that the toll revenues didn't come up to expectations, which, you know, we have done a lot of work on this tolling information, and, you know, we still have reason to believe that these toll revenue estimates are really overestimates, that they are really too rosy. So, but let's just say that there is a shortfall. You know, there is some kind of theoretical option that the state could say, well, we're not, that the legislature could say, well, we're not going to make those availability payments. But in fact, at that point, you've got a bridge. I mean, it's very hard to stop once you start. And so I guess that's sort of the thing that makes me nervous about this bill. And as a citizen of the state, you know, once this passes, then Kibata has the authority to go out there and get that contract. And once that contract is entered into, then that's kind of the last, really, you all have to say about it. And you are on the hook. And I really encourage you to look more closely into the toll revenue. That's the key piece of this. I still think it's quite low. Another thing that I wanted to mention is that, you know, the state actually owns a ferry that could go between the port of Anchorage and Point McKenzie. And that ferry could carry, I wrote it down here, 134 people and more than 20 vehicles. And so I think there are other options for covering the growth. I think I also heard the Kibata representative say, and many people say, that it's not the bridge that's spurring the growth. It's just growth that's naturally happening in the valley. But really the key question is, where's that growth happening? Because without the bridge, it'll still be happening closer to Anchorage in Palmer or Wasilla, where the state already has invested a lot in infrastructure. That's where our infrastructure really is. That's where it's strongest. We've made big investments there. And why wouldn't and people will move there if the bridge would, in fact, encourage growth to the places where it's sparsely populated right now. And so I don't think that we can assume that the population growth would require a bridge. I think we can assume that some population growth would happen in the western parts of the valley, but that really it would still be concentrated in the eastern parts. So I think we should question this idea that we really, really need this bridge to support population growth that's going to happen already. I just think that's just a little bit of a weak argument. I could go on and on, but I guess I'll stop there and see if there are any questions or anything you'd like me to address.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'd like to thank you for taking the time and effort to come down here to Juneau today.
Thank you.
What kind of disruptions to those who live in the Government Hill area would take place if this project moved forward? I'm sure you've had conversations with your neighbors over the past mm-hmm. few years, and I'm sure you might be able to relate some ideas as to how lifestyles would be changed.
Well, right. Of course, we all know how painful road construction can be, and the Government Hill, and of course, the project's not completely designed yet, so it's hard to know exactly what the boundaries would be. But for sure, the private partner that would be building this would come in and really dig a big trench through the entrance to our neighborhood. So you would come over the AC Bridge, you would come up and take a left into Government Hill, and a big trench would be dug there with a kind of a cut and a cover tunnel. I'm not really even sure how we'll be able to get into the neighborhood during the construction. So that's one thing. And then the one thing that we haven't talked about at all is phase two of this project. I believe Mr. Hemingway alluded to it when he talked about additional infrastructure that would need to be built. And phase two of the project would dig up the neighborhood again to make the connection to the Seward Highway. And so that would be phase two. The idea is that we wouldn't build phase two until the traffic supports it, so it would have to happen in the out years. So that would be twice. They'd have to sort of dig up the neighborhood again. So it's really going to be a huge impact. And also some of the historical, some of the studies that were done as part of the environmental assessment revealed some very rich historical information that, of course, we sort of knew about but has now been documented. And so there are actually a lot of historic buildings. Government Hill is Anchorage's oldest neighborhood, for those of you who haven't been there. And we have a great, it's just a great little gem of a neighborhood, quite quiet. And we have Quonset huts still there, people living in Quonset huts. We have big houses on the bluff. So we have just a wonderful variety of people and income levels and ethnicities. And many of those, especially, for example, those Quonset huts are pretty old, and so we have some old structures. We have a house from 1915 that's still standing. So those are the kinds of things. It's a very quiet, sort of green little neighborhood. We have a lot of pocket parts, and those are the kind of things that would be disrupted by bringing, really, this large highway through our neighborhood.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming today. We really appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you.
Off net, we have Bob French. Bob, are you there?
Yes, excuse me. My name is Bob French, and I appreciate being able to testify today. I am president of the Government Hill Community Council, and although my comments today are my own and not of the Community Council, one has to wonder why, for 7 years, Kabata has been happy with the existing wordage of AS 19.75, and why Kabata's monetary obligations now need to become obligations of the state. The answer, I believe, is what Kabata has been saying since 2003, and I could paraphrase. They've been saying, if this project does not make financial sense to the private sector partner, then they won't support it and the bridge will not be built. Kabata has obviously talked to the proposed partners, and the conclusion's clear. They will not play the game unless you completely change the rules. Give them a state guarantee and provide another $150 million for a reserve fund. The private sector, I believe, does not want to touch this project if they have to assume the financial risks. And why is that? Well, because they don't believe the toll forecasts, and I don't think you should either. Let's take a look at the basis of those tolls of traffic. Kabata has not yet published their 2011 toll collection estimates, but based on their 2011 TIFI loan application, it appears as if their most recent toll estimates are lower in the early years to match the lower populations, but are the lower populations than what their 2005 toll estimates included, but they are the outer years are similar to what their earlier estimates had, say 15, 20, or 35 years out. Even if the population in the Mat-Su borough today is 11% higher than what had previously been forecasted, the current population still falls far short of being able to make the payments on the loan. You need to have about 21,000 one-way trips a day at $5 apiece just to make the annual bond payments, as called out in Kubota's pro forma. The current traffic to and from the valley on the Glen Highway coming in at the Eklutna Bridge is 29,000 trips a day, and it's not a shorter trip to use the Kinnickahn Bridge unless you live west of or south of Wasilla. So most of the valley will continue to use the Glen Highway. Kubota's forecast that they will have 20,000 trips per day over the bridge only 3 to 5 years after it opens, I don't believe is a reality-based estimate. Kubota says the bridge is going to facilitate state commerce, as it's going to shorten the time to travel to Fairbanks. Notice they say that it's not closer to Wasilla or Palma, which is true, it's not. But the question is how much closer? Well, their own traffic time estimates say that it's 14 minutes closer to Fairbanks. Kubota has letters of support from the Truckers Association. Did Kubota tell the truckers that they're going to have to wait until after the Burma Road is actually built to achieve that whopping 14 minutes of time savings? I also wonder if truckers are going to pay a $10 or $15 toll just to save that 15 minutes. Kubota testified that this is going to be part of the National Highway System. But did they tell you that Phase 1 will not be built to National Highway standards? I'm sure that you may have seen Kubota's video, the one where they show four lanes of traffic flowing along over the bridge. Did Kubota tell you that it will not be a four-lane bridge and a four-lane approach roads until Phase 2? Well, Mr. Otteson's correct that the roads will be necessary to be built throughout South Central, regardless of whether the bridge is built or not. I believe that if their forecasts are too optimistic, the Kubota project will be so far in debt that Kubota will not be able to finance Phase 2 and instead will look to the state to fix the problems caused by the bridge. Even so, Kubota is still not, they're very clear in being that they will not pay for any project south of 3rd Avenue or past the connection of the Connect Goose Bay Road and with Point McKenzie Road. So the traffic on the KGB Road, which is already so overloaded, as Mr. Otteson pointed out, it's one of DOT's designated safety corridors. It's entirely outside of the state. I'm sorry. It's the state's obligation to find the money to upgrade that road. Representative Newman said that he was looking forward to money from the bridge coming in to be able to help to pay for some of these roads, and even Kubota will be able to tell you that they are not looking to actually have any excess funds until at least 15, 20 years out. So one of the other things that Mr. Otteson referenced was the highway-to-highway traffic estimates and said that they had a higher traffic estimate for the bridge. It's interesting that he talks about that because the Government Hill community currently has a public information request that is now past due with DOT, specifically regarding the conditions of that estimate, because we have reason to believe that the highway to highbreak project did not include the dampening factor of having a toll on the bridge. So obviously, once you add in the effect of a toll, you get probably a 20 or 30% drop-off in the amount of traffic that you could expect. So I certainly appreciate your time in reviewing this whole process here, and I urge you and the state of Alaska to not make that $3.2 billion mistake in giving a guarantee for those $3.2 billion of availability payments. It doesn't make sense to spend $3.2 billion just to get a $700,000 bridge. And I also I don't believe those current estimates. I don't think there's any project that has ever come in on time underestimate. So I could certainly respond to any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Mr. French. Appreciate your comments. Do you want to make comments? Jeff Otteson, would you like to come forward and
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd just like to correct one thing in the previous testimony. The gentleman indicated that the project would not be built to NHS standards because it would not be a four-lane bridge at the outset. NHS roads in Alaska, almost 95% of them are two-lane highways. That's a perfectly acceptable standard under the federal highway rules for a national highway system route. What he might be thinking of is an interstate standard. The interstates in the lower 48 are, without failure, built to four-lane standards minimum and often many more lanes than that. But even in Alaska, we have 1,000 miles of interstate that are built to two-lane standards. All of the parks, all of the Glen, for example, even the very rural sections are technically considered interstate under federal highway rules, and there's an exception for Alaska to have two-lane interstates. So we're not proposing to classify this as an interstate, but it has been classified tentatively as an NHS by Federal Highway Administration, and a two-lane standard is perfectly acceptable under that classification.
Okay, thank you. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was wondering if Mr. French was correct when he said that the phase one of the bridge would only be two lanes going, one lane going each direction from Anchorage to Matsu. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Peterson, I'd like to have Kubota staff talk about the geometry of the bridge, both phase one and phase two.
Okay. All right. Yeah, that'd be good.
Okay. Come on.
Thanks. Forward.
Thank you. Through the chair, this is Mike Foster, Representative Peterson. The foundation or the bridge structure is actually built out for four lanes plus the pedestrian or bicycle lane. The initial deck of phase one potentially could be the two lane, but we will also ask when we go out for solicitation the four lane as an option. The concept is that you build it two lanes on a foundation. You build the foundation once. You build a deck for a two lane, and as traffic expands, you add additional decking to that. You know, on the Glen Highway and stuff, you just add additional, you come in and you add additional pavement, and you get another lane on a bridge. If you don't have a little bit of foresight, you have to add a lot more to it than just pavement. You have to add the foundation. So the bridge structure is set up for four lanes and pedestrian. Phase one potentially could be a two-lane, or depending on the proposals, it could be four-lane. The embankment structures are all filled out to the full four-lane standards. The cut-and-cover tunnel that was referred to earlier is constructed out to the four-lane phase two alignment, and so it would be cut once, covered once. And then when traffic reaches its phase two capacity, then Ingram Gamble would be the next connection into the Seward Highway.
I see.
Follow up, Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the $700 million estimate is for the two-lane deck, is that correct?
That is correct. That is for the four-lane cut-and-cover tunnel, the four-lane embankment, the four-lane foundation superstructure, and a two-lane deck on the bridge.
And one more follow-up.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And is there an estimate what the additional two-lane of decking would cost?
Let me turn around and ask that. I was told it was about $100 million to add the additional decking to it.
Thank you.
Representative Munoz.
Mr. Hemingway, please.
Mr. Hemingway?
Thank you.
If you could come forward. Representative Munoz has a question.
Thank you. On page 2 in section 5B, the new language regarding the obligation of the state. Is it typical in private public partnerships for the governmental agency to assume all risk?
To Representative Munoz through the chair, this is Kevin Hemingway. The government is not assuming all the risk in this transaction. What we are obligating to on a subject to appropriation basis, with the first pledge being the toll revenue, is the annual availability payment. And the annual availability payment, just to remind the committee, is projected to be about 67% of the base case traffic and toll revenue during the 35 years planned for the agreement. Under a normal procurement, of like a DOT procurement, the state is responsible for 100% of the cost. It is responsible for the design-build contract and potentially for a significant part of the overruns or the design-bid-build contract. It is responsible for all of the operations and maintenance. And actually what a public-private partnership does is two things. It makes transparent the life cycle cost of the ownership of the project, and it puts brackets around the state's risk and shares and offloads a lot of that risk to the private sector, much more so than in a conventional public transaction. The availability payments, remember, take care of all of the operations and maintenance to a standard that is very high, and handing back the facility, which is a 100-year asset, to the state in like new condition at year 35. So all the literature that you'll read on public-private partnerships will really imply or indicate that the risk is substantially lower. Yes, the public can typically have a lower cost of capital, but it also assumes all the other itinerant risk of constructing, operating, and maintaining the facility. So I would strongly argue that this is a lower risk structure, and it's also transparent about the life cycle cost of ownership. When you get a capital appropriation for a road in Alaska, you just have some vague idea of what it's going to cost to maintain it and resurface it, but there's no transparent look at what the life cycle cost of that road is when you appropriate for a typical project. In this case, it's all laid out before you.
Okay, Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Hemingway, and I don't know if this is to you or to anybody else, or maybe we need to get this from somebody else. We're looking at a pipeline that is going down in both the quantity of oil that's going through it and needs more additional refurbishment and replacement to keep it up. We're having problems with our revenue sources around the state. We're having increasing demands on our limited state. Has anybody looked at or done a study? If we put the money into this, how will that affect our opportunity costs to maintain the state and do other things? What will the trade-off be? What will we be taking money away from if we buy this? Do you or do anybody else in the room know that?
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Mark Newman, District 15. Representative Grunberg, what's the cost of doing nothing? That could be the inverse of this. What's the cost of doing nothing? I mean, we can sit here and have congested roads. We know the state population is growing. Maybe the state population will drop in half if the pipeline continues to run at a decline and stops operating in 7 years. That could probably happen, too. But what's the cost of doing nothing in this state? Do we continue to lose lives, congested roads? You know, District 15, we talked about the growth there. That's 27,000 people in my district now. And that's north and west of Wasilla. And that's the northern part of the bridge. You know, and so the numbers are right. There's a hedge in there, and there's a hedge on the hedge. And so that's why we have contracts. And that's why when this project, you know, moves past this step, when there is a contract negotiations are completed, that does come back in front of the legislature, we look at all that again and decide, are we going to continue to move forward this project? But what's the cost of doing nothing? You know, we could sit there and say, we have a project here that we've shown the numbers that after 35 years it's paid for and it's putting money into our economy. That's diversifying our economy. We've got an opportunity here, but we've got 100 jobs that we don't have right now. What's the cost of not having those in our economy? Those are jobs in your backyard, Representative Grunberg, my backyard. So what's the cost of doing nothing?
Yeah.
Representative Groomberg, I'd like to move this bill, and if you guys keep talking, we won't have time.
I won't. Say a word. Brevity.
Well, I don't want to move it too fast.
Representative Groomberg.
And I'd just as soon that it not move today, but that we get all the information we need before we pass a vote on this thing. This is extremely
Representative Groomberg, we have answered every single question that was brought up at the last meeting, and that's why we're having this meeting. So, and every question that's been asked today has been answered. So, Representative Groomberg, do you have another question?
If I may.
Yes, you may.
Thank you. The cost of doing nothing depends on what doesn't get done. And I haven't had that answered yet, because if we only have a certain amount of money.
Representative Groomberg, say that again.
Sure. We only have a certain amount of money, and something's not going to get done.
We have had that since the beginning of time.
I realize that, but please let me finish answering my question. Asking my question, okay? The question is, what won't get done? And you put a case that if we don't support this project, it won't get done. My question is, if we do support the project, if anybody can tell me, and maybe this is a rhetorical question, but I think it's worth the members of the committee deciding, what won't get done? Won't a ferry get built? Won't projects up in the Chickaloon area get built? Won't things in Juneau get built that need to be built? Won't things in East Anchorage get built? Those are the questions we have to ask, just as you, Representative Newman, are answering that for your constituents. I'm not being flip, Madam Chair. This is the core question before us.
If we only had a crystal ball.
Yep. And thank you. That is something that comes up all the time. We still have one other person that would like to testify. So I would. Ron Axel is online. Ron, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Would you please?
Madam Chairman.
Okay, state your name and affiliation, please.
My name is Ron Axtell, and I am I've been a resident of Alaska for over 30 years, and I have lived on Kennett Goose Bay Road for the past 29 years. Over the years, I've seen that area grow, mainly in the last 10 years, and we ask ourselves, what can we do to support the economy of the state? We need some areas to grow. Showing companies that the state is willing to give support for development can only be seen as a positive move. We are already moving that direction with the oil industry. The state cannot continue to rely on big oil as our sole source of income. In building this bridge, you will be helping support other types of the industry that are looking to develop in our great state. An alternative route to the interior and developing our resources are just two ways the state can benefit from this project. The state also needs to look into the future a little closer in the aspect of the one road system in and out of Anchorage. I'm sure no one would argue that with the growth of the Anchorage Bowl and the Matsu Borough, the highway will constantly need to be upgraded as talked about earlier. What will this cost be? The money that this bill is looking for will be pennies compared to upgrading highways and overpasses to accommodate the amount of traffic in the future. I believe that this bill is a positive move to show future investors that we are open for business. People say this is a bridge to nowhere. Let's make it a bridge to somewhere. Thank you for hearing me today.
Thank you very much, Ron. Appreciate your testimony. Is there anyone else in the room? I'm going to close testimony. Testimony is closed. And what's the will of the committee?
Madam Chairwoman, I move House Bill 158, version M, move out of committee with fiscal note, which I don't have here. And individual recommendation.
Okay.
I object.
There's been an objection. Do you want to verbalize your objection?
Well, I actually have just seen these questions from that were asked by a previous committee at the other end of the building, have not had a chance to review them in detail. Even though a lot of our questions were answered today, I still would like to look at additional details to see if I have additional questions in the future. I think this is there are still some questions about this, and I think we need to review it further.
Madam Chair,
Representative,
would answering those change your vote?
If they were answered to my satisfaction, yes.
May I respond to that, please?
No. What I would like to do right now is have the secretary call the roll.
Madam Chair, I am going to have to appeal the ruling of the chair. I haven't had a chance to be heard on this central question.
You have had more of a chance to be heard more than anyone else on this committee, so I refused to give you the floor right now. And we have answered all of the questions except your last question, and there's nobody in this room that can answer that question. That question will only be answered by the Finance Committee. They're the ones that will decide which projects will get funded and which projects won't get funded. So that was the only question that didn't get answered.
The only question.
So, Secretary, would you please call the roll?
Yes.
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 No.
No.
Yes. Okay. With four yeas and two nays, House Bill 158 is now moved out of committee. And this meeting is adjourned at about 3 minutes after three.